This week's episode is brought to you by Kevel's Retail Media Cloud. Built on an API-first foundation, this platform empowers retail media networks to flexibly customize ad experiences and enhance their data control, resulting in more tailored ad experiences for users. Don't settle for black box limitations or the costs of building alone. Kevel's Retail Media Cloud brings together the power of ad serving and CDP personalization to create on-site ads for retailers and marketplaces in a privacy-safe way. Launch a retail media network that your advertisers will love in as little as 14 days. To learn more, go to kevel.com/listen. That's kevel.com/listen. Welcome to the Marketecture Podcast. I'm Ari Paparo. I am joined today by Eric Brunchy and Joe Zappa. Joe's the founder and CEO of Sharp Pen Media. He's an outspoken person on Twitter. He says a lot of interesting things about marketing and content marketing, and we're hoping to get some real great insights as to the state of advertising, your B2B ad tech, MarTech company, and why so many companies are not great at it.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Ari.
Some quick housekeeping. So this week's Marketecture interview was with Cortex. So that's with a Q. It's an interesting video company that does overlays on top of video ads. So it creates new inventory for publishers they can monetize. And it's spelled with a Q. I'm just going to remind you of that. And then the ongoing mission to get people to subscribe to the Marketecture newsletter at news.marketecture.tv. Last week, we did a ramp up article that was very well regarded. And this coming week, I think we're talking about cookie spoofing, which is going to be a topic in the news of the week. So that should be very interesting. I'd recommend subscribing and sending it to other people to subscribe to. It is free.
Highly controversial. Highly controversial topic. You got to subscribe. Ari's got like the final thoughts
on it. Changing the name of the newsletter. Used to be, we read the doc so you don't have to. Now it's, we follow the people on Twitter so you don't have to. There are some memoirs going on Twitter exactly. On the subject right now. But let's go back from the trenches to talk about more exciting big picture things. So, Joe, tell us just what you do for your clients. What are you actively, you know, working on, and how do you help these companies to make their marketing kind of suck less?
Yeah, we do marketing strategy, content, and PR. So I was a MarTech journalist. I was the editor of the trade site Street Fight. And then I started ghostwriting bylines for ad tech and MarTech execs. And then quickly, to your point about strategy and why ad tech marketing sucks, you realize, well, they need more than bylines. They need someone to help them think about how they're going to grow their audience and grow their business. So we help with all of that.
So why does so much ad tech marketing suck?
I think first you need to talk about, like, in what ways does it suck, right? So I think it sucks in three ways. So the first is that there is an alignment between marketing and a business objective. So a lot of founder CEOs come through the door with me, and they are essentially like, we need to get the word out. And what I would like to get them to, if we do work together, is a more specific objective. Like, we feel like we're the premium option in our market. Like, we have a much better product than our competitors, but no one knows that. Or we don't have any top of funnel awareness. Like, we have no name ID, or we do have top of funnel awareness, but we're not like guiding people down the funnel. Like, when you have specific business objectives like that, you can then achieve them with marketing, and you can tailor the marketing program to that. The second is that the message is undifferentiated and no one cares about it. So if you go to a lot of ad tech and MarTech sites, it's like, we help publishers do good things. And it's like, all right, well, that's what every sell side ad tech company says. So no one cares. Like, a better one would be like, I work with a company called Bird Intelligence. They're a publisher BI tool. Their new tagline is Take Back Monday. And the idea is like, ad ops people are stuck in all like pulling data from 20 SSPs. We help you no longer spend your entire Monday manually pulling data because that's ridiculous, right? So it's like more specific, something they actually care about. And the third thing is distribution. Like, a lot of ad tech companies are running a playbook that would have been appropriate before Facebook was invented, right? Like, they're basically relying on reporters to get their message out. And like, reporters are great. Things like this podcast are great. But like, the media is just one channel to distribute your message. I would like to see way more ad tech companies mixing it up on LinkedIn and Twitter and the Slacks, where they can reach their customers every day.
Really great summary. And we could probably spend a full episode on each of those three pillars. On the second one, the undifferentiated product, isn't that tough? Because so many ad tech companies do have direct competitors that it's hard to differentiate from. You know, we make publishers more money, or we help advertisers create more yield, or we save you time in ad ops. Like, there's probably 10 companies that could stand behind each one of those three examples I just gave out. How do you carve out the differentiation?
Yeah, it is tough because commoditization is the biggest problem in ad tech, right? Like, everyone gets lumped into a category and they generally are very similar to several other companies in that category. So I think there are two ways around it. One is actually via distribution. It's just to be a lot more present than your rivals are. Like, I think like ad tech, Twitter is a great example, right? Where it's like, it's active, but it's not that active. So like, if any ad tech CEO wants to get on there and like build a profile for themselves and then like by extension, get on here or like get featured in the media and start like becoming an influencer and like develop an audience among publishers or advertisers, that's something they can do. That opportunity is available to them and most people don't take it. The other is exploiting a connection between what your product does specifically, like a nuance in your product and what your audience cares about. So like, I collaborate with Paul Connickton, who used to be your CMO at Beeswax, Ari. Like, the story he always tells about this is that like, Beeswax is relatively complex and granular, like as a buy-side technology, right? And so he says, you know, Beeswax was for control freaks. It's for people who like want to get into the details. And I think someone on Twitter shared like a perfect meme to encapsulate this, where it was like a very simple looking machine and it was like captioned every DSP. And then it was like an extremely complex engine and it was captioned Beeswax. And like, your average like business person would probably hate that because they're like, we need to be simple and whatever. But it's like, no, we are more granular and we are for the 20% of advertisers or agencies who want that product. So let's tailor our messaging to it.
Yeah, I was pretty happy with the control freaks thing because I think it went from a bunch of products and features we were describing, like Bidder as a Service, Customize It, whatever, to more of a persona that someone could relate to. And I think that's generally good marketing. Although the side effect is that the Europeans hate it. It had a negative connotation in Europe, which is always a tough kind of thing.
So can we talk about number three, which was distribution? I think, Joe, you've done a really good job of articulating how things, you mentioned before, like, you know, people are using tactics that are, you know, maybe a decade or 15 years old, right? Like pitching journalists and relying on that to build reputation. And you've been pounding the table on it needs to be about individuals and, you know, like, you know, execs need to become influencers. That's a really good take and an interesting take for B2B. But, you know, if you're not Ari, right, and you haven't developed this reputation and this voice and this audience, and it's a CEO that you think is like bright and personable and can really do this, like, how do you advise them to start becoming their own, you know, sort of voice and influencer and mouthpiece of the company starting from zero?
Yeah, it's a great question because I do think you have to, the exec has to want to do it on some level. Like, there are people who are just like, Twitter is disgusting to me and I will never go on. I'm like, okay, fine. That's not an opportunity that's available to you. I think that's a loss, but like, you do you. If you are willing to do it, but you're like, how do I start? I think the marketing person's role is to enable them. So you enable them with messaging and then with content and then with advice on distribution. So like, all of my clients, I try to give two tiers of messaging. You have the high level message, which is like the Take Back Monday thing, where it's like, this is what we're about as a company. This is our core value proposition. And then we create a house topics and POVs doc for every client, where it's like, here are five issues in the market that people are talking about on a daily basis. And here's our position on them, so that at any time we or you should be able to look at that. And you're like, I want to post something on Twitter today. Okay, here are five ideas that are always relevant. And then you can iterate on them based on what's in the news. And then, of course, the content people can actually write some content for you. And what the best people will do is they'll then customize that a little bit. Because obviously, I know what's going on in the space. I know how the company fits into the space. But the exec has their personal voice and their personal experience that ideally they can weave into it.
I'm just sort of shocked at how few execs engage in social broadly. I understand if you're a big public company, the limits to what you could say, and not everyone wants to be Elon Musk out there, thank God. But, you know, I advise many startups, and Eric obviously is an investor in startups, and you're like a 10-person startup trying to change the ad tech world. You should probably have something to say that's differentiated, right? Especially if you're under 30. What's the barrier? Are they scared to put themselves out on the line?
I think there are some people who are scared to make waves. I think there are a lot of people who don't see the value. And as investors, maybe you guys can help me out a little bit here, because I think a lot of CEOs, especially of small companies, are like, they will straight up say to me, just like, well, what is the ROI on like posting on social? And it's like, it's a fair question, but it comes from a place of being like, I will not believe this has value unless I can like put it on a dashboard. And it's like a Facebook ad where it's like, I put in X and got back Y. And like the answer I give is like all of B2B marketing with high consideration, high value deals, which is most of ad tech, is building awareness and trust to drive relationships. And the way you do that today is by being present on Twitter and LinkedIn, which allows you to build an audience directly, but then also influence the influencers like you guys who then amplify them so that when an advertiser is trying to figure out what's really going on in this ad tech space, like, I think I might need a vendor here. Whom do they look to? They look to you guys and the people on Twitter are influencing you. That's how I got here, right?
Yeah. I mean, I'll give you a quick case study. All of a sudden, you started popping up on my feed, Joe. I was like, wow, this dude is super smart. I did a rare outbound DM to you. I was like, do you want us to get together? I'd like to like learn more about you and how you help companies. We had a meeting. We hit it off. The next day, one of our founders said, we fired our PR agency. Like, this is the third time we've done this. I just need someone with a fresh approach. I said, huh, I got a guy for you. And you connected with that founder. And then I started following you. I retweeted your stuff and it's turned into now I think you're being amplified to my audience. So this is an example of like how this stuff can work and work really fast and be productive.
Joe, what's a baby step? Like if a CEO wants to start getting their word out, is it a LinkedIn post once a month? Is it or do you have to get engaged in ad tech Twitter or just something else?
I think the best thing to do is actually not to start posting from your own account. The best thing to do is start commenting or posting on your own feed. The best thing to do is start commenting on what other people are saying, which ideally should be easier because then you don't have to come up with something from scratch. But in the beginning, the way you build a social following is by going to the Eric Franchis and Ari Paparos of the world and commenting on what they're doing because they already have the audience that you want. And that's how other people who matter are going to discover you.
That's a really good point. And I have personal advice for everyone out there. I'm interested if you agree or disagree, Joe. Snarky, but positive. That's my advice. If you want to say something funny, go ahead. If you want to make a comment, make it positive. Don't come in and burn down the house when you disagree with somebody.
Yeah, I agree. It seems to work for like one or two people in the space, but I think those spots have been taken. I think generally you want to be positive. But also don't be afraid to take stands. Like you have to have positions on things.
Right. If you disagree, do so politely because you're just jumping into somebody else's thread. No reason to burn down their house.
Right. Exactly. And I'm often surprised on social by how people struggle to get that concept of like, you know, we don't need to just cheerlead all the time. That's boring. But also you can just disagree politely. It's a thing we all do.
All right. PR agencies, total waste of time or partial waste of time?
It's not that PR is a waste of time. It's that like the age of doing a 10K per month PR agency where all you're doing is pitching reporters or bylines are over, right? Like it needs to be a more modern strategy. Like PR, I just saw a post today by a PR CEO where he's talking about, you know, the media is dwindling and this is a crisis for us. And it's like, well, yeah, the media has been dwindling for like over 10 years, right? It's like the media is still important. Pitch them, develop relationships with them. But also reach your audience every day on the channels where you can do that, right? Again, Twitter, LinkedIn's, industry Slack communities. And by the way, when you're active on social, it also makes you more effective with the media. Like I developed relationships with reporters in the space by commenting on their stuff on Twitter, right? So all this stuff feeds each other.
Are there channels besides X, LinkedIn, and Slack that you advise clients to develop, like building an email list, starting a YouTube channel? Like there's, you know, probably a handful of other frontiers that I think have not been ruined by B2B marketers and ad tech CEOs. Is there like something that you think is interesting and worth diving into?
I think driving people to an email is like a classic strategy that still works. Again, if you have something to say, I think it's a little harder because it's a bit easier to rattle off tweets or LinkedIn posts than it is to like write a, you know, 1,000-word newsletter or 500-word newsletter on a regular basis. I also think that an underexploited opportunity for ad tech companies that sell to the buy side that I haven't cracked yet either is TikTok and Instagram. I've heard from some people sort of behind the scenes that this is where they're reaching agency and brand marketers. And obviously, like, people have, I think some people are just like, no, like, I don't want anyone from work on my Instagram. And like, I'm the same way. Like, I have a personal Instagram. I like just created a work one and I haven't really started using it much yet, but people have multiple accounts. Like, you have a work Instagram and you have a personal Instagram. And I think like that is where you're probably going to reach a lot of the, like, you know, young agency market.
Okay, listeners, you have to chime in. Should Marketecture have a TikTok or not? Please DM me. And it will involve Eric dancing and me explaining things in incredible detail. One thing I want to add something, since basically we took a, we started spending a lot more time on the newsletter at Marketecture like about a month ago. We moved from MailChimp, which is really just kind of a boring mail service, to Beehive. And I think people underestimate how sort of viral and how much growth you could get out of the modern newsletter platforms, like basically Beehive and Substack being the two leaders. They have built-in referral programs. They have built-in growth tools. And you can really actually get kind of a pretty big audience on those tools if you really work. It's more like a social network almost than an email platform.
Yeah, and Tyler Denk, who started Beehive, and I think he was like the number two employee at Morning Brew or something, he's actually a fantastic example of growing a software company through social. He has like a massive audience and he has his own newsletter and he talks about like the business, like he talks about email and how to help people do that. But he also just talks about his own journey as an entrepreneur.
Yeah, I think I was actually convinced to switch to Beehive based on his social feed, you know, because I was considering different things and I just, his presence really put me over the edge on that. Can we get some examples? Like, you know, who's doing really well in our community with advertising? Hopefully not one of your clients. So yeah, specifically not one of your clients. Who does really well with marketing in our world?
So there are a couple individuals I've seen recently where I'm like, okay, this person is doing a really good job. Paul Gubbins at Publica by IAS, he creates these videos on like what's going on with CTV. And, you know, they'll get hundreds of reactions. And I asked him straight up, I was like, you know, ad tech people on the buy side will swear that you can't reach brands and agencies on social. And, you know, he says, no, you can reach them. Like, it's, you know, it's harder. It's much harder than reaching ad tech people. But he's been creating content, it seems to me, for probably like a decade. And if you consistently share helpful content, you're going to do really well. That brings up two points for me. One is that the content has to be educational, right? So he's not just like shilling for public or IAS. He's walking people through, here are the different types of CTV. And as a marketer, here's what you should be thinking through. The other thing it brings up for me is that, like, don't get discouraged if you're hearing this and you're like, I'm going to start posting on social. If someone with a very large and engaged and long-term audience posts something and someone who's just starting out posts the exact same thing, the second person will get like 1/100th of the engagement just because they don't have goodwill with the audience. So I think there's often an assumption when you're starting out, you're like, oh, I must suck at this. Like, no one's paying attention to my content. Like, it takes a little while to build that goodwill. The other person I would call out, and I actually highlighted this on Twitter, is I was really impressed by InfoSum COO Lauren Wetzel's appearance on here. Like, she had a great answer when you were talking about the Live Ramp Habu thing, which had just happened when she came on. And then I also see her like mixing it up on Twitter. Like, when this is coming up, she's engaging. She's talking about it. She has a narrative about, you know, Live Ramp is out all about data centralization, and I'm not sure they're going to be able to get away from that. To me, when I see that, I'm like, okay, if I were an ad tech CEO, that's the type of person I would want in my corner who's like out there evangelizing for the company.
Yeah, worth also noting that Paul Gubbins is not the CEO of Publica, and Matt Barish is not the CEO of Index Exchange. It's kind of like the lieutenant is out there, you know, fighting the good fight, because the CEO, in case of a public company, probably is a lot more reticent to go out there.
Yeah, it can be either. It definitely doesn't have to be the CEO.
Yeah, so you should look to hire someone who's very extroverted, good at writing, and maybe a little obnoxious. That's the key, I guess. I want to ask you a specific one question. So the Trade Desk has a sort of a AstroTurf publication called The Current, and people like to make fun of it. I mean, it's disclosed. Everyone knows it's the Trade Desk, but you could be confused and not think it's the Trade Desk if you ended up there on a search link or something. How do you feel about that, both on a effectiveness level? Is it effective? And secondly, on like kind of a ethical level?
Yeah, I think a lot of ad tech people get mad about this, and I think there's like a specific thing that is legitimate, and then overall, I think like the anger is overblown. Like, the thing that I think is legitimate is I think it would be pretty normal if at the top of the current homepage, which last time I navigated there, this wasn't the case, it said like, you know, buy the trade desk or something like that. Just so they're being like totally above board about it. And it's like everyone knows like this is owned by the trade desk, but it's also like an independent media site in its own right that does good work. I don't think that's the case. Now, if you scroll to the bottom, I'm pretty sure you can see that and you can Google it. Like, again, this isn't like a totally clandestine thing, but I think they could be a little more upfront about it. That said, overall, like this is a thing that other companies have done. It's not like totally new. There are consumer companies that pour like hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars into these like brand publishing operations. It's just essentially like excellent top of funnel marketing, right? Like ideally you want to have thought leadership that isn't directly tied to the brand, that isn't selling people, but that's just bringing people into the brand's ecosystem. And they're hiring really serious journalists to do that. And overall, I would applaud that. I think like be upfront about it. But if you want to pay journalists $1 million a year to amplify your reach as a former journalist and a marketer, I'm in favor of that.
What do you think about Jeff Green's word count? You'd cut a little bit, right?
Yes, I think he should use the good people of the current to tweak the word length a little bit.
All right, let's take a break and we'll come back with the news of the week. We've got more news about cookie deception from SSPs, the Reddit IPO, TikTok being banned, and some other interesting stuff. So we'll be back in a moment.
Thank you, Joe. That was an awesome segment. We're going to get right into the news of the week. There's a bunch of stuff this week, but we want to kick off with something that I believe Marketecture broke in terms of like this being something that's out there a few months ago, but Adweek had an exclusive here. And I'll just read the headline. Exclusive: cookie deception sparks tension between buy and sell side in IAB Tech Lab. The buy side claims that they've been duped by SSP's solutions for cookieless environments. Ari, want to explain this to us?
Yeah, we talked about this. I don't know if we broke the story, but we definitely had some original reporting on this about a month ago that SSPs are doing everything they can to have IDs in the bid stream, even when they don't really have a legitimate ID. In the least controversial thing they're doing is they're doing a thing called ID bridging, where they're using the IP address to pick up a cookie that they might not otherwise have. For example, a Safari browser that doesn't have a cookie, but the same user using IP address does on a Chrome. In the most shady thing that we hear people are doing is that SSPs are fully making up IDs that are unreliable and putting them in the bid stream to convince DSPs to bid and to believe that they're frequency capping when they're not. I think the story is well reported. Everyone should read it. I'm going to cover it more in the newsletter. And as soon as this came out, I got a text message from someone who works at a big DSP who said, this is absolutely true. It's happening. It's rampant. So I think this is a big story. And as we move into the cookieless future, it's going to become a bigger story.
Is this, and again, I won't, people should read the newsletter, but just as a preview, is this something that you think is like a very deceptive practice being done intentionally? Or is this just like lack of communication, SSPs and sell side trying to, you know, do some stuff to increase the value and the yield of IDs? Like, where does this fall in terms of the, you know, good intentions versus bad intentions from your early perspective?
Right. I think it's a range. And I think it'll get cleaned up because there are different options in the OpenRTB spec as to where to put these IDs, and where you put them, it gives information to the buy side about how to use them. And so I think the biggest problem is misclassification, where people are using probabilistic IDs and passing them as deterministic or passing them as cookies. It is fraud. It's just the question about whether it can be cleaned up and how much damage it's doing.
Ari, how much of this is about the industry getting on board with probabilistic IDs increasingly displacing deterministic? Because that was a big feature of the story. And I understand there's some stuff that's just shady that's going on, but then it seems like some of it is just like norm shifting.
Right. Yeah. So the biggest distinction between probabilistic and deterministic is reach. So probabilistic has much higher reach because you're guessing effectively. And so there's always going to be this desire to pass off probabilistic as deterministic, high reach, high accuracy, when it shouldn't be. I think we're going to see a lot of this because even if you're in the deterministic camp, like I wrote in the newsletter last week, you're going to want to use some probabilistic to extend. And I think that it's all about the counterparties really enforcing what is already documented and the correct practice according to the OpenRTB spec.
Okay, cool. Well, everybody should sign up for the newsletter so they can read more of your thoughts
on
this.
And read the Adweek article, which is out right now. And then my newsletter will hopefully add some value to that Adweek article.
Yes, the Adweek piece was well done, well reported. Okay, we got some platform stuff to talk about. First thing was, last week, the S-1 was filed by Reddit for their IPO. It's been a long rumored thing, very interesting path, very interesting company. So we got a chance to see what a large advertising business looks like. So Reddit's 2023 revenue was $804 million and actually produced a $91 million loss. So, it's a money-losing business. I think a couple of things are interesting for the audience here. So number one, Reddit is an ad business. 98% of their revenue comes from advertising. And that advertising is 0% audience targeted. It's 100% powered on context and user interest. So I think it's a little bit of an interesting kind of counter trend to, how the other big social nets do their thing. The other thing that, I think is small but kind of interesting and maybe a view into what, revenue streams might look like in the future is the other 2% of their revenue is a licensing deal with Google to train Google's AI models. So I think that's interesting. That could be a one-time thing. That could be an annual thing. But, overall, it's, pretty rare to see a big ad biz, prepared to get out for an IPO. What do you guys think? Is this going to be a successful IPO, an unsuccessful IPO, or, does it get taken out potentially beforehand because now everybody sees the numbers?
I think it's interesting in that if you think about the size, relative size of all of these public companies in terms of their gross advertising spend, you see some patterns. Like some of the larger public ad tech companies are reporting annual revenues in the, billion-ish range in terms of amount of spend that goes through them. And now you have Reddit, which is sort of a leader on the internet, right in that range, $800 million in revenue. Kind of gives you a sense of the size of all of these second-tier players. By second-tier, I mean behind, obviously, Google and Meta and things like that, sort of a size of the breadbox analysis. On the Google deal, my understanding is that it's $80 million a year with the three-year deal and it's non-exclusive, free money. And it could be interesting to see if this becomes an important part of revenue for many publishers who have updated interesting text or video content. There's a question about it, whether it's sustainable or if it's a one-time thing and over time the models won't need it. But I think that's great. It's a great green shoot for the struggling publisher business.
Agreed. Joe, maybe I'll ask you a specific question rather than comment on the IPO. Do you advise clients to spend time on Reddit, whether as users, whether to promote company stuff, to do promoted posts?
I think the tricky thing about Reddit is that it's notorious for being a community of people who are averse to selling and averse to advertising, right? So you need to be very careful, I think, and you need to really treat it like top of funnel. I mean, this is good advice for any social platform, but it's you can't get on there and chill. You've got to just engage and be part of the community and let your association with a product maybe lead people to it, but you can't shill. I have a question for you guys, which is as a lowly discourse merchant, I've never understood with Twitter and Reddit, it just seems like they should be such contextual advertising juggernauts, right? I know that that's what I use both of them for, right? I'm on ad tech Twitter or tennis Twitter, or I go to tennis Reddit, especially with all the privacy changes and advertisers needing scale and ways to reach relevant audiences. Do we feel like that's an opportunity that's been undertapped on those platforms?
We've long, kind of beat up on, X's ad business and that it can and should be much larger. And I think, there's one line of thinking that it should be, focused on contextual. There's another line of thinking that it should be focused on real time and video, but they've yet to crack it. And I think on Reddit, absolutely. It's already an $800 million business. And it's 100% contextual because, all users are anonymous. There's no ability to do audience targeting. So I think it's a check in the four column that, contextual when done right can build an ad biz. What do you think?
Yeah, I think there's a ceiling to it about how big it could go. Twitter, the ads aren't big enough, or the ad formats aren't great. And the feed, the main feed that people spend all their time in, the context is very weird. It's very hard to have brand safety, and it's hard to tell when someone's being sarcastic or not. So there's a lot of problems with it. But they've done very well on their second tab, the Discover search tab, whatever it's called on different platforms, where the NFL has been a longtime partner of theirs, and other sports companies have put in a lot of really high quality ads. So I think Twitter is missing a lot of opportunities based on the way they've developed their product. Also noteworthy, no one ever talks about them, but Stack Exchange has a pretty big ad business to the tech community. So if you go into a Java forum, there's a lot of Java ads. I don't know what the size of it is, but it's a really good contextual model as well.
Do you guys use the word Twitter intentionally?
That's what it is, man.
I've been saying X the whole time, and neither of you have said X.
I don't have a moral objection over the name change. I'm never going to call it that.
Noted. Okay. We'll keep going. Some platform stuff. So, this is ad important, but not direct ad news. So there is a surprise announcement this week. So a bipartisan group of lawmakers introduced a bill that forces TikTok's parent company, ByteDance, to divest American TikTok operations. So this has been something that, a lot of people have been pushing for a long time in the name of like security and, all this stuff that sort of kind of goes beyond the scope of this. But I think that this actually, if it happens, can accelerate TikTok's ad business, because I think that there's probably some degree of holdback from brands really wanting to invest in this thing because the future is unclear. If this becomes like an American company with no connection to the CCP, I think there's potential that this thing starts to take off. What do you guys think?
Depends on if they spin it out, if someone buys it. Depends on how a lot of things. I think this is a really good thing. When I was a kid, when I was growing up, there were media control rules. It's like the Soviet Union could come in and buy my local TV network. Like, that would be insane. I think it should be absolutely regulated that apps that collect personal data should not be allowed to be, or should be regulated as to, their ownership by foreign entities.
Yeah, agreed. I'm getting ads on YouTube for TikTok, talking about from a small business perspective how important TikTok has been to American small businesses. Like, there was a farmer talking about how they've been able to, improve and save their business because of TikTok. So this is a
that actually folds into a different topic that's not in our show notes, but the mini bubble in Chinese money buying ads on Facebook and Google. Companies like Temu, I don't remember how to pronounce it, are spending literally $6-7 billion a year on Facebook right now. And it feels very unsustainable, and it feels very questionable whether they should be taking the money. I just wonder if either of you guys have seen that cross your radar. Any thoughts of being paranoid because it's Chinese money, or is this a real thing that they're just trying to gain market share?
I mean, I think they're just trying to gain market share. The Temu thing is interesting because it's like, they're just pummeling us to death with ads. And that, to me, it's like an overexposure question. Like, I guess it succeeds on awareness, right? Like, you can't help but notice it. But are you actually driving some like negative brand affinity by seeming spammy? Which is, I also still don't understand how it's going to make me feel like a billionaire. And I'd love to understand
that. Yeah, that brand promise is very weird. Also, one thing that people don't talk about too much is that TikTok spent billions on Meta for several years in order to get the user base that they have right now. It was not organic in the US entirely. So I wonder if Facebook regrets taking that money.
That's a really interesting question. On the Temu stuff, I guess, almost throw a question back to you. If they weren't pouring the $6-7 billion, into Meta properties and everything else, does that hurt the ad market, or does that just like kind of default to a set of like lower paying advertisers from a CPM basis and nobody's
Well, Eric Suford, our colleague in Marketecture, has actually covered the subject that he believes that there is some crowding out going on where other retailers and like D2C brands are having a really hard time finding their audience on Meta properties because they're being outbid systematically by Temu and other Asian competitors. But it is an auction. It's fair. So I mean, like, it's hard to argue that's a bad thing. They're just using capital as a weapon. There's something a little fishy going on here.
Yeah. Speaking of Meta, so Facebook is really, really killing news this time. There was an announcement, and their announcement said that they're focusing on what the audience wants, which is to talk to their friends and short form video. Do you guys know that there's a news tab on Facebook?
I haven't logged into Facebook in like 4 years. No,
so for for the audience, they're both shaking their heads, and I don't think they want to talk about this at all. So I went and looked for Facebook news. It is on the left-hand navigation bar. For me, I had to scroll down. It was right in between Messenger for Kids and Orders and Payments, which I've never interacted with. And it accounts for, I think, like a very, very low single-digit percentage of usage on Facebook. So I don't think this has any bearing on publishers.
Well, there was a report, I think, 2 weeks ago that some users were seeing the news tab disappear on Google search, which was a little more impactful, potentially, that Google may only show news if you're really looking for it, as opposed to suggesting it on all of your searches like they currently do.
Yeah, interesting, interesting. Okay, all right. We'll keep going on the platform stuff and some stuff that's a little bit more ad tech relevant. Comcast Advertising launches a household verification service. What's this?
Break this is one of those news articles that only I care about, but you listen to my podcast, you have to hear about it. So what it appears to be is that Comcast, obviously as the largest cable provider in the United States, has their set-top box data across a huge number of households, and they're offering a service where they will allow you as an advertiser to verify that you reached certain households with your advertising. They're using Block Graph, which is sort of like a clean room technology that we also interviewed on Marketecture. And it appears to just be a service. I'm really trying to read between the lines to figure out why they're doing this. But I presume if you are running, say, an addressable TV campaign or maybe a CTV campaign, and folks are selling you based on IP address, you can then send the log files to Block Graph. And they will tell you if the IP address stuff that's being whipped up by your ad tech vendor is really working, or if there's some deception, some mistake, some fuzziness there. And presumably, you have to pay them a fee. This is not a freewheel product, and it doesn't appear to be an effective product. It's a Comcast advertising product. So, you know, if anyone knows more about this and wants to clear it up, feel free to slide into my DMs.
Absolutely. Going along. So Microsoft's announced its own sandbox for the Edge browser that is slightly different from Chrome. So now we have the entire ad tech ecosystem working on sandbox and devoting a lot of engineering and product cycles to it. And, you know, Ari stays up at night reading all sorts of documents. And now apparently Microsoft wants us to do the same for Edge, a browser that has 8% penetration on desktop. Is this going to be something that people are going to divert Chrome sandbox cycles to?
Well, Paul Banisher was excited about it. And if he's excited, I guess it's a good thing. I'm just going to use him as a proxy. But the Microsoft documents were pretty clear. I haven't read them in depth yet. They appear to have gone right from Google and then made some improvements, some differences with the Chrome approach, which people seem to think are good. I'm tired. I'm just very tired of this whole thing. We're only in March. So, you know, I'll keep an eye on it, but I don't really have a strong opinion just yet.
It's a marathon, not a sprint. Stop being all in on sandbox, especially when you're not operating an ad tech company. All right. Final platform piece of news. There's been a ton this week. So IAS launched, I think, a new MFA solution, or like put out some news about their MFA solution. I think this is interesting from two perspectives. Number one, they are making the statement that MFA stands for made for arbitrage. When I first read that, I was like, huh, that actually sounds good, right? Because New York Times, you know, if they didn't have a subscription business, that would be a made for advertising business. Made for arbitrage is a much different thing. And I think, you know, connotates this whole game of buying traffic and sending it to a site stuff with ads and all that stuff. So I think that was interesting. What do you think about it?
Yeah, I think it's interesting. There are going to be various approaches to this. And I think there was just a Digiday article about this that was getting a lot of attention. Like, I think the way DV is approaching it is they have a list of problematic characteristics of sites, and then they have tiers. So the advertiser, I believe, can decide how much like MFA risk they essentially want. And then, like, you know, if it's like the low tier of risk, some people might be fine with taking on those sites that other people would call MFAs, whereas like other people are going to screen out anything that looks like an MFA. The other thing I see here is this seems like a good lead-in for like contextual advertising companies, in that like MFAs are part of the story. Like, really with MFAs, what we're saying is like, yes, people don't like them. There's like a political push against it because like bad publishers and good publishers need the traffic and all of that. But it's also just like, it's not relevant and it's poor quality and it doesn't make for effective advertising. But there are all sorts of other sites that advertisers buy like home pages or channel fronts that aren't relevant to like granular advertising campaigns. Like if you have, you know, if you're advertising for a specific medication, like you don't want to buy like a health page that is like, you don't want to buy Yahoo Health necessarily. You want to go find the pages that specifically relate to that medication and the people who have the illness that it's meant to treat. So I think I would hope, and I see contextual advertising companies doing this, that the issue will also draw more attention to like precise targeting in general, because you don't just want to screen out MFAs, right? You want to screen out all cheap reach opportunities that are cheap reach, but not good reach.
I think it is a little bit of a shot at DV, because DV came out with sort of a subtle approach to MFA, and IAS is coming out blasting on all cylinders. So it's fun to watch that sort of competitive differentiation.
It is. And they seem to be, IAS is like aligned with Chris from Jounce, who we had on a couple of times last year. And basically they're like asking two fundamental questions, which is the majority of traffic organic or paid? That's number one. And then number two, is the primary purpose of the site to deliver content or ads? Which again is the Chris playbook, which makes so much logical sense from my standpoint. So I think this is pretty neat. All right. Platform news is done. There was a ton this week. One quick funding announcement that I thought was interesting. So there was a big Series A after last week's big big Series A and pre-B with the CTV companies in retail media. This company called Topsort raised a $20 million Series A. I think what was interesting about this was twofold. Number one, it was at 150 million posts. And then number two, it was led by a Latin American VC called Upload Ventures. And I'm not familiar with Topsort, so I spend a little bit of time on their site. And actually, Joe, maybe we can get your take on this in terms of ranking this in terms of, you know, kind of communication and brand. But they say they're a retail media infrastructure tool. They say they're a clean room, and they say they're an ad network. And I'm not familiar with the business, but from a person that like looks at this stuff and marketing and comms all day, what do you think? And why is it worth 150 million post?
I don't want to be too tough because I'm just looking at this for the first time. So like the hero text is like connecting the post cookie world of clean advertising. That gives me a sense of like the arena they're playing in, but I don't really know what they do yet. And so I'll have to keep reading and I will discover.
I felt it was a little bit of a disconnect between the article in Ad Exchanger, which I thought was pretty well written, and then I went to their website, and it felt like it was a different thing that they're promoting on their website. I think what it is basically an ad network for PLAs, product listing ads, that goes after kind of small and mid-sized retailers, and they have a clean room approach so that they could sync data somehow. That was how I read it, and I actually DM'd. I did the cold DM to the CEO to see if she's willing to get interviewed on Marketecture, because I would love to hear more about the company.
Cool. That sounds great. And, you know, again, just for, you know, maybe inside baseball for my world, but a 150 million post on a Series A is pretty hot. So I'd love to learn more about the bits from that perspective. All right. Apparently, this company called Avast, which is an ad block company that uses a Chrome extension, has been selling user data and has been fined by the FTC, $16.5 million in order to not sell user data at all. So you'll put this one in the link for folks to read. It's a pretty deep announcement on the FTC site. But I think this is crazy that people are downloading an extension to their browser. When you download an extension to your browser, it says this extension can read every single thing that you do. And then in the case of a bad actor, they're then selling that data. And they're an ad blocker. This whole thing is, I can't get over how ridiculous thing is. And maybe I'm a little bit too fired up, but what did you guys think of this one?
I think on the surface, it's horrible. It's absolutely ridiculous. I think what it raised some people's eyebrows here is, first of all, as we all know, there is no privacy requirements in the United States, more or less. There is no law. Yet, this was prosecuted. And then in some of the remarks of the FTC folks, they seem to start painting a picture that they may use enforcement as a way to kind of tiptoe the United States into privacy world. They said things like, you know, it's not acceptable for companies to use your consumer data in ways you wouldn't expect. That's interesting. Like, I thought it was totally legal in the United States to use data in ways people didn't expect, as long as it was in your privacy policy. But maybe not. Maybe the Biden administration is getting a little more aggressive in the same way they have on antitrust.
Yeah, it could be a canary in a coal mine. But like, to me, this is nuts because an extension has all of a user's browsing data, like literally all of it. And being able to, you know, just sort of like kind of have that sold is not good.
I have a follow-up question for Joe. So it feels sometimes like one of the reasons people communicate so poorly in ad tech is because they don't want to say what they're actually doing. And then when people actually say what they're doing and it's on their website, it turns into fodder for negative PR or even legal liability. Have you seen this as a problem?
Yeah, it's a problem that every company faces. And I think the answer is that you have to do both. Like on the top of your site, there should be one line that's like the big vision. And then there should be another line that's like, literally, we are this, right? So it's like, we are a publisher BI platform. You know, that's what, that's very down to earth. It's what the publishers call it. You got to tell them that's what you do. And then you have the other like bigger picture thing where it's like, you know, we're saving you time in this like glorious way that's going to make your life better.
But what about the thing that low the line that says, and we correlate everything that consumers do across their phone, computer, website. We even watch them with their webcam when they're asleep. You know, you don't want to say that, but if it's part of your business, it's hard not to say that. That's obviously a ridiculous example, but you know what I mean.
Yeah. Well, that's where you need to deploy the dark arts of saying what you do in a way that your customers will understand it without getting in trouble with watchdogs, which is a dark art in which I would never personally participate, of course.
Of course. Well, we saw that a couple months ago when that division, it was like Cox Media was like, we listen to your phone calls. And everyone just totally freaked out. They really just shouldn't have said that.
Right. Yeah. Don't say that
for sure.
Part.
Anyway, last bit of news for the week. Outbrain, who public company and has had a unique co-CEO situation for some time. Yaron, who I know and is fantastic, he has decided to leave the co-CEO post. So David Kosman is going to be still CEO, and Yaron is going to be chairman of the biz moving forward. Yaron's great. He's got a lot of interests. He reads 5 or 6 books at a time. So I think he's going to have a whole bunch of reading time, and I wish him the best. And we'll see what happens with Outbrain in the future.
All right, let's call it on that. This is a great episode of Marketecture. Joe, we really appreciate you giving us some of your insights. You can find Joe on Twitter. You can find Eric and I on all the platforms other than Facebook, soon on TikTok, maybe. And please subscribe to the newsletter. Eric, thanks for everything. Joe, thanks for being here.
Thank you, guys. Thank you, Joe.
Thank you for subscribing to Marketecture. New interviews are added every week at marketecture.tv and your favorite podcasting app.